This is the Dungeon Master Guys.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the third episode of the Dungeon Master Guide podcast. I'm your host, Philippe, the chatty DM Menard, along with my friends Dave Chalker. Hey Dave.
Hey, hey.
And our other co-host, Newbie DM. Hey, Newbie DM, how you doing?
Bonjour.
Bonjour. We got a great show for you today. We will be talking about improv in your own games. Dave's going to discuss this subject with his friends, Bartonius and Quinn. Then we're going to discuss using the what if technique to create a seeds for a new setting when you want to start a campaign in an homebrewed world. And our newbie's going to talk to us about using props at the gaming table. But our special feature today is going to be a discussion with game designer and freelance writer Chris Sims. Newbie and I will discuss cursed items with him and his various thoughts on using them in both D&D 4E and in other role-playing games.
And before we get to that, we've got a few words from our wonderful sponsor, Obsidian Portal. Take it away.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
So, thanks to Obsidian Portal for that. And so, recently, both Quinn and Danny, who goes by Bartonius on Critical Hits, were over at my house playing D&D, and afterwards we chatted about recently I had a game where I hadn't really planned much and had to sort of improv things on the spot and was talking about the challenge of that, and they had a couple things to say about that. So let's take a listen. Okay, so I'm here with two of my compatriots in Dungeon Mastering, Danny from Critical Hits and Quinn from At Will.
Hey.
Hey.
So we're going to talk about improvising games on the fly, and I bring this up because I ran a game on Sunday that was mostly unplanned and ended up going to Sigil from the old Planescape stuff and now Dungeon Master Guide 2, and was kind of surprised where it went, and in fact, the decisions that the players made, we ended up having our first no-combat game. And that's just, you know, how they made, but it's not one of my strengths. So what do you guys think about improvised games, slow planning?
I sort of flux wildly between the two. Sometimes I prefer to prep everything up to the nines and just go through, and then, you know, if you have to improv, at least then you have something built up to, like, improv above. You're like, oh, I'll just reskin this whole combat thing, so you're never really offbeat, and then... and then sometimes you're just like, you just, not only are you not prepared, you just don't feel like preparing, you're just like, I have an idea where I wanted this to go, and then I'm willing to, like, run with the ever. So for me, it's a little mood driven.
That's also probably the tenor of the game, right?
Yeah, definitely agree with Quinn on that one. But over the last probably 2 years that I've been running 4E, I think I've developed sort of a pace where I plan a certain amount and then I end up improvising quite a bit. And it helps with me because I'm never 100% sure where my party's going to go. I mean, Dave's in my party, so that ruins everything. I've had instances where I've run an adventure and the party's ended up going into a dungeon and I've completely improvised the dungeon 100% room to room. And it's just, I would suggest not being afraid of just adding things in. Literally, I just set up a room and put as many entrances as looked like it would fit out of it, and some had gates across it that later, and I ended up throwing a lever in that would open that gate and shut another gate. And it's literally just making stuff up, and if you put in enough at the beginning, then you can eventually tie everything back to those things and make a very interesting dungeon. But on the flip side, you can actually, if you plan out a dungeon a lot beforehand, you can end up with something really cool, but you run the risk of the party completely avoiding it or going the wrong direction and avoiding half of the dungeon or, you know, a lot of wasted time. So I'm sort of happy with the half-planned, half-improvised method that I'm using right now.
But like, I am pretty bad at spatial stuff, so I feel like you, someone who's more spatial, has an easier time saying, well, it would make sense for this room to have three doors. Like, you know, I have no sense of that. It's more kind of random for me when it comes up, which is why I prefer to plan it.
Yeah, I guess there should be a disclaimer that being an architect helps with improvising dungeon design. So I apologize for that, but I think the DMG has the good random dungeon design. If you go with that, just don't stick too rigidly to it. Just use it as sort of a primer and realize that you can add in the same kind of randomness on your own.
I mean, and there are tons of just random dungeon generators, like, you know, on the net. It seems like almost everyone who's ever done programming, who's been into RPGs, makes a random dungeon generator at some point. So there's
lots of algorithms to choose from.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can choose one of those, you know, and that's an important thing, too. It's like sometimes I think the most important thing to do in improv is to prepare to improv. You know, if you know, like one thing is to cover things that the first thing you want to do is cover things that you might be weak at making up on the spot. So for you with the spatial stuff, you might want to make sure you have a library of spaces so that you don't have to make that up. Or, you know, for someone else, it might be names. So you want a name generator, things like that, or, you know, PCs, all those sort of things you want to sort of get prepared. And then once you get your core prepared, then you just have random stuff. We were just talking about, today, the ultimate toolbox.
Yeah, great there for that.
It's great. The only problem with it is it's so big and it's so comprehensive, it's hard to quickly find stuff.
Yeah, I think for me, one piece of advice that I took on Sunday that made it work a little bit better was that I took breaks so that I could, you know, like because I knew where the PCs were and I could. It gave me a framework about where they might go next, and I think by taking a break, you can whip out something like the Ultimate Toolbox instead of having to kind of flip through, like, they ask you a question, and you're like, hold on, I have to flip to this page and roll a die, and then it comes up with this, and then they know it's random. If you take a break, you know, at an opportune time, you can somewhat generate some of that stuff, even if it is more on the fly, you know, as long as you're giving yourself time to do it in the game.
Yeah, help out. That's actually a great thing that I hadn't thought of, but the breaks, what I do is I try to consciously pay attention to when the party isn't fully into it. Like, you know, as you're running a game, every once in a while some PCs will start joking, and you'll realize as a DM you don't need to be paying full attention. So at that point, I'll start looking through my notes and start planning out what I'm going to essentially improvise on the spot next. So it's sort of on-the-moment planning and throwing things together. And really, I think the toughest times I've had is when I start to get nervous about it, so I just try to relax and keep it simple and then build up the complexity of what I'm improvising as I'm comfortable with it and not throwing too much in, or not being afraid of throwing something in that if the PCs do go into it and I don't have something planned, maybe it doesn't lead to anything right now, or you can hint at something later on and then build on it later when you have a chance.
I feel a lot of sort of when characters, when you have it open and you can react there, sort of characters can do stuff. And when characters start taking action, they have these skills and powers on their character sheet. Those are sort of signifiers for what they want to be doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the great things about improv and like that, you know, you have like a party full of thieves and they all have really high sales skills. So obviously they want to break into places. So it lets you sort of design an adventure that's challenging, but within the parameters of what they're doing, because you're just reacting and sort of molding it around. You're like, okay, I'm going to let you get here, and here's the obstacle, and here's the challenge. And then you have to bust through that, maybe with your stealth, maybe with other things, and go for it.
So if you have a party of all fighters, it's really easy to challenge them, because it's like, okay, here's another fight. So let's get to it. You know. Yeah, that all sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, that was interesting. That's one of my weakest point improv. I'm a very structured DM, and I really like to know where I'm going with a story. Not that I want a railroad adventure, because I will usually write a lot of choices or leave room for the players to decide to go where they want to go. But improv, not so much. What about you guys?
I'm not too crazy about improvising adventures either.
Yeah, it was kind of rare for me to be in that scenario, but I think it worked out, and it's still good, even if you're a heavy planning DM, like it sounds like the three of us are, to be able to pick up on those tips just in case something goes completely off the rails. And let's face it, we can't always be prepared.
Yeah, you're right. We're not all Boy Scouts. up next is my segment where I use a creative technique that I mention often on my blog called the What If technique, where I will sit down with a piece of paper and a pen and ask myself a series of what if questions that will often lead me to create old adventures or even campaign settings. And that actually is how I created the Gears of Ruin and City Within campaigns that I've been playing in the last year. So let's listen to how I ended up with a new campaign world. One of my favorite ways of creating a new adventure or setting for D&D is to play the What If game. The What If game is a creative exercise where you ask yourself a series of What If questions without any barriers because of the game, the rules, or logic. And you just see where it leads you, and then you use that to flesh out whatever adventure setting or monster that you want to work on. So why don't we just try that to see where it will lead us today? I was thinking of let's say we want to create the generic fantasy setting. So what if humans never made it past the Bronze Age? And what if the elves actually took over the world and developed technology? And what if the dwarves were the nature lovers? And we could play with that. So what actually happened to the humans? They probably retreated to the mountains. And what if they stayed barbarians and are the world's boogeyman? And what if halflings were the main merchants of that particular world? And the merchant princes were dragons. So, you see, just with a few questions, you basically reorganize the roles of the different fantasy races to create the seed of a world. So now you've got a world where the elves are dominant life forms, the dwarves are probably in forests, and you could apply their historical craftsmanship to all kinds of wood items and protective magic for the forests. You would have merchant princes, dragons with their halfling hirelings, and you could have those barbarian humans basically playing a role of orcs in your game. So, you see, just with a few questions, you can trigger something completely new, and that could actually help you design your own setting or an adventure or whatnot. So give it a try and let us know how it works.
So it's basically like a big brainstorm session to create your campaign world.
Yeah, it's a brainstorm session. This is one of the things I've noticed with role players or GMs creating their games is that while they try to brainstorm, they have what I call the judge. They judge themselves a lot, and they shoot down their ideas. So one of the very critical parts creating a new setting or a new adventure is to just throw ideas on the table and not to judge them. And from there, you'll find some really weird stuff appearing, and you can start making relationships between your various lines that you write down. So that's basically structured brainstorming.
Interesting. Well, I want to present my segment now, and it deals with props at the table. And do both of you guys like using props in your games?
I use a lot of stuff on the table for the miniatures and whatnot, and I even have pieces from old terrariums that I use and from other games and whatnot, but I've never really been into the whole, like, here's a scroll or, you know, here's a feather that you would find or something like that.
I will use, you know, I will put a lot of effort into drawing very detailed maps for battle maps and whatnot, but I don't use props all that much.
Yeah, I'm big on props. I like finding special fantasy fonts and parchments and create handouts and putting things up on the table. Well, why don't we check out my segment?
All right, I'm here with Randy Walker, also known as Dead Orcs on Twitter and on his blog Initiative or What. And Randy's going to talk to us today about using props in your game. I'm a big do-it-yourself guy. I made my own tokens, my own maps, tiles, and stuff like that. So I'm a big do-it-yourselfer. And Randy's going to talk to us a little bit about aiding the immersion with your players using props. So, Randy, what do you got for us?
Well, first of all, thank you, Newbie, for inviting me onto the show and letting me talk a little bit about some of the stuff I do in my own game. Like I said, like yourself, I'm a big do-it-yourselfer. And I like to make sure that when I'm running a game that I try to make the experience as immersive as possible. I'm probably a frustrated a LARPer, but I've never had the guts to actually go that far. So I like to do some things that that help bring people out in the game. And some of those ways I do that is with props that I can make myself. One of the big things that I've started to do with my campaigns is to create my own set of coinage, currency. There are a few products out there in the market that are like fantasy currency, but they're really expensive and you don't get very much to actually play with and stuff. And I actually figured out a way to be able to do that really well by buying large quantities of like plastic discs, painting them and then stamping them with my own designs or with design stamps that you find, so that they duplicate the currency of the realm they're in. And the reason this is so immersive is because when I'm actually conducting a transaction, it actually improves your role-playing because you're actually exchanging a physical material back and forth across the table. Right. And I actually – if the player doesn't bring their stuff with them, the coins they've accumulated or whatever, they don't have it for the day. It's either misplaced, back at the inn, whatever. But it helps the players – remember that, you know, if they want to participate in certain activities during the game, they're going to need to remember their stuff.
Oh, so you actually make it a part of the game. If it's not at the table physically, it's not in the game.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the players actually keeps what they call party treasure, you know, stuff that doesn't get divided up right away. And so that stuff stays with him. And if he doesn't make it, the party treasure is misplaced or locked in a chest somewhere or something. And so it just adds that little bit of, you know, wow, we need to make sure that we take care of this. So, and that's one of the things I do. And I've got some blog posts about how I actually created the coins, and I won't go into necessarily that here. But the nice thing about it is that the prop is fairly inexpensive because you can get these acrylic plastic discs, you know, at like educational supply stores and stuff like that, and you know, a couple coats of paint and some stamps and you're good to go, and you can create massive quantities. So I've actually had rooms where they've gone in and after they've defeated the monsters or whatever, they open up an actual chest and actually see the coins there. And so it's just that tiny little bit of immersion. It's not a big deal, but it's just enough to help add to the atmosphere.
I'm gonna go to your website next time my wife asks me for jewelry. I'm gonna make her an astral diamond.
Oh, there you go.
That'll get her off my back.
Yes. My wife makes jewelry, so I know how I know what you feel like. Yeah.
Oh, buy me something. Here's an astral diamond, honey. Go buy yourself. Yeah. Go buy yourself a bag of holding or something.
Exactly right. One of the other things I've done, and I haven't done it for my current games, but I've done it in the past, and that's when scrolls used to be pretty popular with spells and things like that, particularly with older editions of the game. I would actually take wooden dowels and take strips of paper, print out the spell on it in like a fancy font, and roll it up on the dowel, stuff that into something, and actually hand them a physical scroll.
Very cool.
I've done that. The game I ran previously was a 3.0/3.5 game. This is before 4E came out, of course, and I was looking for something to do potions with. And since I had all adults in my game, I actually mixed vodka with food coloring. And each potion that they found was this little – I found these little inexpensive plastic test tubes and with stoppers, and I mixed them up and handed them out. Now, the stoppers kind of leaked, and they didn't really work out whole well, but they're for a couple of games. And when they had to, when they used a potion in the game, they actually had to drink the potion at the table.
I hope you took people's car keys when they first got to your house.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a whole lot, so, you know, it was pretty.
You know, you could be held responsible if something happens.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they were all adults. I had them sign a waiver. No, but, you know. But, yeah, it was one of those experiments that wasn't the best of the world. But, you know, you try these kinds of things to try to help. And it's funny to see a character actually or a player at the table actually have to think for a minute, wow, do I really want to drink this if I want the potion's effect? And not that any of the guys weren't drinkers at the table. But, you know, it's like, yeah, do I really want to do this? So it put some thought in it, and it was pretty fun.
That's funny. I use a lot of I do a lot of Photoshop stuff for my game. I do tend to print out, you know, handouts and notes and scrolls and that type of thing.
Exactly.
I've never gone to the point where I'm using the dowels, like you said, to make an actual scroll. That's kind of cool. I'm just not very handy in that sense. I'm very handy when it comes to like digital work on a computer and stuff like that. But once you ask me to make stuff out of wood, that's a whole different arena for me that I'm just not very good at. I'm kind of like Homer Simpson in that regard.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm not much different myself. I mean, I find a lot of things, you know, I kind of use like found object stuff. I mean, I'm not out there in the woodshop carving my own dowels. I'm going and buying a package of dowels at the craft store, you know. And but yeah, and using a combination of – the great thing about the computer is that you can print out fancy scrolls and things that look like parchment and things that look like burnt text and everything else, you know, and cut it and paste it and stick it on there. And it looks really pretty cool in the game and serves as a great prop.
All right, perfect. Well, Randall, I want to thank you for coming on the Dungeon Master Guys podcast.
Oh, thank you, newbie. I appreciate it.
No problem. And there you go, guys. Some cool ways to use props in your game to make it more immersive.
Yeah, so that's my segment on props, and I recorded that with Randall Walker from the Initiative or What blog.
Well, we have a very special treat for you today. We have the pleasure of having Chris Sims with us. Chris Sims has had a long experience working on at least two editions of D&D. You worked on the third and the fourth edition of the game, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, and now Chris, on top of working on several secret freelance projects, also writes for Critical Hits, and we're really happy to have him with us. So, Chris, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, we invited you because we just sent a curse on you. You won't be able to leave the show ever. You're now one of the hosts. I'm sick and tired of doing it. So, while we're on the subject, why don't we talk about cursed items? A lot of people have different opinions on them. A lot of people who are from the older school think that they should be punishing objects that are a danger for exploring and you know, playing around with things that adventurers shouldn't know about. Whereas I think we've seen a shift in the newer school about using cursed objects for different purposes. So why don't you tell us about your thoughts on cursed items and how they should feature in games like D&D 4E?
I think that cursed items should be something that drives the story and something that's interesting for players. It's not just, you know, a penalty or something that's a bummer and you just want to get rid of it. I almost would like to see all cursed items that aren't just hazards or traps be something that a player really decides to keep despite the drawback. And because despite the quirk that the item has, it's valuable and it makes the game more interesting because it's present.
Chris, how do you think if I wanted to take the cursed items and use the 4E artifacts mechanics to use that? How do you feel about that?
I think that could work really well. I think that how badly an item affects a player should be, I mean, a character should be determined by the player of that character. So the character can appease the item and the curse diminishes because the character has appeased the item temporarily, and maybe eventually the appeasement is enough to reduce the curse permanently.
Yeah, because if there's one thing about cursed items in previous editions of the game, especially in the older D&D, was that you really had no choices as a player. It was sort of X is going to happen to you and you're screwed, and it's, you know, until the DM says so. And 4E sort of gives players and DMs a lot of choice in basically everything about the game. Everything about the game is choice. And I don't see why cursed items should be any different from that.
Well, yeah, to me, a cursed item that's in the total control of the DM is a trap, really.
Yeah.
You know, like the cloak of poisonousness that we were talking about. You know, you put the cloak on and you might die. That's a hazard or a trap. That's not an interesting story-driving, action-driving item that the whole party or at least one character can interact with.
Yeah, but the cloak of eternal rash can lead to interesting things. You know, so it acts as a cloak of protection, and it gives you more bonuses that you should have to get at your own level. But your character always scratches, especially in social situations.
Yeah, take the old robe of vermin. I mean, it's an older item, but it was in third edition, and it gives you a penalty to initiative checks in third edition. I mean, that seems reasonable if you're, you know, if the encounter starts and you're busy scratching because vermin are crawling all over you, then that sounds reasonable.
Let me ask you something. This is a cursed item, and I'm speaking again of 4E specifically, because that's what I DM. You have the monster themes, for example. You have a regular monster, and then you can lay a theme on top of the monster to give him some flavor. Maybe he could be a cultist of so-and-so, for example. Right. Is that something that you see cursed items being? Like, you have a regular magical item, and then you have a theme that you could apply to the magical item to make it a cursed item. Because remember, in 4E, a player character only has to play around with a magical item for 5 minutes, and he can determine what magical item it is. So how do you keep the fact that it's a cursed item away from him?
Well, the curse wouldn't be revealed by just handling the item. The curse would have to be revealed when the item is put in a situation that is appropriate to the curse. And I agree wholeheartedly with the idea that a curse could be like a template that diminishes the cost of an item, for example.
I think the 3 had a similar design where you would have a dagger that needs to bathe in full blood under the full moon in order for it to be functional.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, item. But it might be more interesting for an item like that to require you to do something not so tasteful in every encounter.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or pay a price, or do something that's less tactically sound for you to avoid that curse. Well, let me give you an example. What if you had an item that you can't use its property or power until it has been bathed in the fresh blood of a slain sentient creature once per encounter?
Yeah. Which can be templated to as soon as an enemy drops to 0 hit point.
Right. Or you take a standard action, perhaps, to bathe the item in the blood of something that you didn't you didn't kill it, but it's a dead creature, so, and you want to use the power, so that there you go. But where you might have a countermeasure or something on that item that maybe you injure yourself with the item and the item is appeased, and then you can use the power after you do that. Something like that.
So as a DM, how do you know if you've gone too far with a cursed item?
Players complain.
Complaining players, or I mean, because players will complain about a lot of things.
I don't know if it's complaining players. I think that most DMs can tell when something isn't fun for someone. If everybody just seems annoyed by a cursed item, then it's not having the intended effect. It's not a cursed item isn't meant to annoy. It's meant to make things unusual. At least that's my opinion. I mean, it's not just this awesome +2 sword with this awesome power. You also have to, you know, cut yourself with it before you can use it or whatever. Or you have to hit a friend with it before you can use it or whatever.
Or it starts singing in the presence of orcs.
Right. Something like that. It has to be a disadvantage, but it's more interesting if the disadvantage can be mitigated. And in a way that makes the game more interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the last part of a cool cursed item. So you need a story. You need to have the cursed item present in your game so that it moves the story forward. And I think that you need to conclude that particular arc with that. The way to get rid of that particular item needs to be part of the story. And you don't need to, you know, remove cursed ritual or whatever. Remove cursed scroll if you use an older version of the game. I really think that a cool cursed item needs to have a quest related to removing the item, and the item should probably disappear at the point where players start getting annoyed by it.
Right, or change form.
Yeah,
like you complete the quest that the item requires of you, and it's completely appeased, and now it's just a normal magic item of that type, maybe with an interesting quirk like that recalls the curse, but doesn't really have a mechanical effect.
Why do you think we haven't seen a cursed item roll for 4E yet, 2 years into the game?
I think it's it's a hard territory to tap. It's not easy to design something that fits in the 4A space and then does all the things that you want a cursed item to do. I mean, and like we said before, some cursed items are just going to be traps. I mean, for an item to be something that a character wants to carry around, or a player wants the character to carry around, it has to be more interesting than that. And that's tricky to design. I took a stab at designing that stuff, like I told you, and it wasn't included in the book that it was intended for, probably because the developers looked at it and said, this is an idea we can use. It's just too tricky to do it right at the beginning of the game or when the game is still young. It needs to, we need to be a little more steeped in the way this game works before we start tinkering around with cursed items, and especially cursed items that players can influence and can be interested in. Mm-hmm. I think that comes after the game already has a rich environment of normal magic items and even artifacts.
The game needs to mature some, and the user base needs to mature some, and then it'll be riper to be used at that particular point.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
All right, Chris. Well, thank you very much. It was really instructive, and I'm going to think twice about creating actual magic, cursed magical items that will do, other things than having my character lisps or lose their drawers while, fighting.
Have a good night, guys.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye bye. All right, so it seems that my curse didn't work. Hopefully the show won't suffer from it. So why don't we move to an email that we got between the both shows and try to answer that. Why don't you tell us about it, Dave, please?
Well, we got an email here from Jeffrey Duke, and he says, "Hi, guys. I've heard and read lots of disparaging things about the Keep on the Shadowfell. However, it is the first module in a reasonable place as an adventure that new GMs might want to run before attempting to roll their own. What things would you do to make Keep on the Shadowfell a better, tighter, and more fun adventure to run into play?"
Newbie, any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a few thoughts. My first thought is that if you bought it at the store, put it away and go download the one that Wizards is offering for free off their site. Because they expanded on it, they added a personality to the evil guy at the end who didn't have one, and they fixed a lot of things that were quote-unquote wrong with the module when it was first released.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, the module was in fact touched up, and it was pumped up a bit. It was made a lot better. Two, I would look at the encounters and really question whether or not they serve the story and whether or not you really need them. There's just a few encounters there that you could do without running and sort of move the story along nicely without having to fight those battles. And three, keep an eye on the Iron Tooth encounter, even though I think they adjusted it in the rewritten module. But keep an eye out on that encounter, because that can lead to a very early TPK at the start of your campaign, and you don't want to have that.
Especially during the period where if it's they're all new players and they haven't learned how to play together, and as a DM, you're more used to you use all your monsters against stranded characters or whatnot. So that's a very good tip.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add, I mean, the encounter thing is very, very important. But also, you can also sort of make up other non-combat encounters. Like, there's a lot of personalities in the village in that module that people, I've read about online, people have sort of springboarded off, and they've involved, like, the personality from the town a lot more. There's a certain kind of famous goblin that shows up there that people have latched onto. Just be ready for that sort of thing. And also, once you get into running it and get down the basics, try to get a feel for what your players are interested in and see if they latch on to some of the elements, and then you can sort of play those up as you go.
And to, play off that, is you can go on various actual play forums and look at how other DMs of similar experience levels have tackled it and played it while writing, and they wrote about their experiences. All right. Thanks. I just want everyone to remember that you can send us emails and questions at
dmg@critical-hits.com.
Yeah, and or you can leave comments at on the actual show notes that come up with each of every on our which each of our episodes on criticalhits.com.
And don't forget the voicemail.
Yes.
At 305-349-3026. 305-349-3026.
Speaking of voicemail, I think we had a question this month, right? Did we?
Yes.
Hey, DM guys. This is Jeff calling from Wisconsin, USA. I just heard your first episode of the DM Guys podcast. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to another episode very soon. I am recently just turned 30. I've been playing D&D for my whole life, but really, you know, 4 or 5 years off. So I'm just jumping back into the DM seat this summer, and so looking for anything, that any tips you can offer for a longtime D&D player who is taking his first shot at DMing 4E specifically. All right, thanks a lot. Have a good day, and keep up the good work. Bye.
Hey, one of the first thing you should do is look at the Kobold All Adventure at the end of the Dungeon Master Guide. It's a very well-written, simple, straightforward adventure that actually outlines a lot of what you can do with the game. And it's also very adaptable to whatever story you want to do. So, yes, it's combat-focused, but you can actually stretch it out with different rooms. You could draw a whole dungeon around it if you want a more exploration game, or you just keep it focused and remove some of the encounters to for your own taste. I'll give you an example. Lately, a few months ago, I introduced D&D 4E to new players, and I switched all the kobolds for Ratman. And I replaced one of the monsters by a rat ogre, and nobody even realized that it was, you know, switched from the DMG adventure. So that would be a good tip to start. It's easy to use, and it's straightforward and well-written.
Yeah, I think that it can seem kind of lame to start off getting back into it using pre-published stuff. But really, you're just trying to get back in the groove and understand your players and what you know, what they're interested in. So you run this as sort of a test thing, and you know, if they're into it, then you can always, there's, you know, always more stuff that you can pick up to run. Or if you start to get your own ideas and start to get a feel for what the group wants and go from there. I think the key is just to not be intimidated and just say, look, we're all still kind of learning, we're still kind of getting back in the groove of things, and you know, don't try to make it even more complicated than it is by, you know, trying to design your own world and all this other stuff right off the bat. You know, just ease into it. You can always restart. You know, there's nobody's keeping score, and then just go from there.
Yeah, good idea, good tip.
Also, for your 30th birthday, caller, I'll offer you this tip. On my site at noobydm.com, I have a download made just for Kobold Hall. You can download all the maps to scale, and you can just print them out. And I have monster tokens and stuff like that, so you can just download, print, and play, and get to work running the adventure. You don't have to worry about drawing maps or finding minis and all that stuff.
There you go. All right, well, that concludes the third episode of the Dungeon Master Guide podcast. We want to thank each and every participant in that particular show. We want to thank Danny, we want to thank Quinn, and we want to thank Chris Sims, who took a few minutes of his time to discuss Cursed Magical Item. And I want to thank you guys, Dave. Thank you very much.
Of course.
And thank you very much, Newbie, which he was taking very precious time before his vacation to participate in the show. I hope you enjoy your vacation, man.
I hope so, too. It's very expensive.
So enjoy every second of it.
Yes, I better.
I also want to thank Obsidian Portal, our featured sponsor. We will see you next month for episode 4. Thank you very much.